Antiquities, Book 7. 1. How David reigned over the one tribe at the city of Hebron, while the son of Saul reigned over the rest of the people. 2. How, when Ishbosheth was murdered by a conspiracy of friends, David received the kingdom overall. 3. How David besieged Jerusalem, took the city, drove the Canaanites out of it, and settled Jews there. 4. How, when the Philistines twice took the field against him, he defeated them at Jerusalem. 5. The friendship that arose between David and Hiram, king of Tyre. 6. How David campaigned against the surrounding nations, subdued them, and imposed tribute on them. 7. The battle and victory David won against the Damascenes. 8. How he campaigned against the Mesopotamians and mastered them. 9. How, when his own household rose against him, he was driven from power by his son and fled beyond the Jordan. 10. How Absalom took the field against his father David and perished together with his army. 11. How David came down again to the kingdom, lived out his days in happiness, and while still alive, appointed his son Solomon king. 12. The death of David, who left his son a great store of silver, gold, and precious stones for building the temple. This book covers a period of 40 years. Now it happened that this battle took place on the very day that David, having defeated the Amalekites, returned to Ziklag. He had already spent 2 days at Ziklag, when, on the third, a man arrived who had escaped from the battle against the Philistines. The very man who had killed Saul, with his clothes torn and ashes poured over his head. He bowed before David, and when David asked him where he had come from in such a state, he said he had come from the battle of the Israelites and reported that its outcome had been disastrous. Many tens of thousands of the Hebrews had been killed, and their king Saul had fallen along with his sons. He claimed to know this because he himself had been present at the rout of the Hebrews and had been with the king when he fled. He said that when Saul, about to be captured by the enemy, was on the point of killing himself, he had been urged by the king to do it and admitted that he had done so. Saul had fallen upon his sword, but because his wounds were so severe, he had grown too weak to finish himself off. As proof of the killing, the man produced the gold armlet the king had worn and his crown, which he had stripped from Saul's corpse and brought to David. David, now unable to disbelieve, seeing clear evidence of Saul's death, tore his clothes, and together with his companions, spent the whole day weeping and lamenting. His grief was made still sharper by the fact that Saul's son Jonathan had been his most faithful friend and the man responsible for saving his life. Indeed, Jonathan had shown such virtue and such devotion toward Saul that, though he had often been in danger of losing his own life at his father's hands, he not only took his death hard, but also punished the man who had killed him. For when the Amalekite told him he had himself been the one to kill the king, boasting of it as his own doing, and David learned that the man was the son of an Amalekite father, he ordered him put to death. David also composed dirges and funeral eulogies for Saul and Jonathan, which survive even to my own day. When he had honored the king with these tributes and his mourning was ended, he inquired of God through the prophet which city of the tribe called Judah he should give him to settle in. God answered that he should give him Hebron. So David left Ziklag and went there, bringing with him his wives, he had two, and the soldiers who were with him. And all the people of the tribe just named came together to him and proclaimed him king. When he heard that the inhabitants of Jabesh in Gilead had buried Saul and his sons, he sent to them praising and commending their deed, promising to repay them for the devotion they had shown the dead, and at the same time informing them that the tribe of Judah had chosen him king. Now Saul's commander-in-chief, Abner son of Ner, a vigorous man of good natural ability, when he learned that the king had fallen along with Jonathan and his two other sons, hastened to the camp, snatched up Saul's surviving son, his name was Ishbosheth, and carried him across to the far side of the Jordan, where he proclaimed him king over the whole people except the tribe of Judah. He made him a royal seat at the place called, in the native tongue, Mahanaim, and in Greek, the camps. From there Abner set out with a picked force, intending to engage the men of the tribe of Judah, for he was furious with them for having made David king. But he was met by a man David had sent, the son of Zeruiah, whose father was Suri, and who was Zeruiah's son by David's sister, Joab, who was David's commander-in-chief, together with his brothers Abishai and Asahel and all of David's soldiers. Coming upon each other at a certain spring in the city of Jibon, they drew up for battle. Abner proposed that they find out which side had the braver soldiers, and it was agreed that 12 men from each side would fight it out. So the men chosen for the contest by the two commanders advanced into the space between the battle lines, hurled their spears at one another, then drew their swords, and, seizing each other by the head, held on and struck each other in the ribs and flanks with their blades, until, as if by agreement, every one of them died. When these had fallen, the rest of the armies clashed as well, and after a hard-fought battle, Abner's men were defeated. Joab did not let up in pursuing the routed enemy, but pressed on himself, urging his soldiers to keep close on their heels and not tire of cutting them down. His brothers fought eagerly too, and the younger, Asahel, distinguished himself above the rest, for he had a reputation for speed of foot. Indeed, they say he could outrun not only men, but even a horse matched against him in a race. He pursued Abner headlong, running straight on without swerving to either side. Abner turned and tried to outwit his pursuer's charge, and at one point one of his own soldiers told him to give up the chase and strip Asahel of his armor. But when this failed to persuade Asahel to stop, and he kept urging him not to pursue further, warning that if he killed him, he would lose the friendship he enjoyed with his brother. Asahel would not listen to these words but kept up the pursuit, so that Abner, still fleeing, thrust his spear backward and struck a fatal blow, killing him on the spot. When the men who had been pursuing Abner alongside Asahel reached the place where he lay, they stood around the body and pursued the enemy no further. But Joab himself and his brother Abishai ran past the corpse, and, driven by anger over their dead brother to press the chase against Abner all the harder, pursued him with incredible speed and eagerness as far as a place called Ammah, by which time the sun was already setting. Abner climbed a certain hill in that region, which belongs to the tribe of Benjamin, and from there kept watch on his pursuers and on Abner's own men. Then Joab shouted out that kinsmen should not be goaded into strife and battle against one another, and that his own brother Asahel had been at fault as well, since he would not listen when warned not to pursue, and so was struck down and killed because of it. Persuaded by these words, and taking them as good counsel, Joab sounded the trumpet to recall his soldiers and called off the long pursuit. So Joab encamped that night on that very spot, while Abner marched the whole night through, crossed the Jordan River, and arrived at Mahanaim, where Saul's son was. The next day Joab counted all the dead and gave them burial. Of Abner's soldiers, about 360 had fallen, and of David's, 19, plus Asahel, whose body Joab and Abishai carried from there to Bethlehem and buried in their ancestral tomb before returning to David at Hebron. From that time, civil war began among the Hebrews and continued for a long while, David's side always growing stronger and gaining the advantage in the fighting, while Saul's son and his supporters grew weaker almost by the day. About this time, David also had sons born to him, 6 in number, from as many wives. The eldest, born of his mother Ahinoam, was named Amnon. The second, by his wife Abigail, was named Chileb. The third, born to him of Maacah, daughter of Talmai king of the Geshurites, was named Absalom. The fourth he named Adonijah by his wife Haggith, the fifth, Shephatia, by Abital, and the sixth he named Ithream by Eglah. While the civil war continued, with frequent clashes and battles between the two kings' forces, Abner, the commander-in-chief of Saul's son, being a shrewd man and holding great goodwill among the people, kept them all firmly loyal to Ishbosheth, and for a considerable time they remained devoted to his cause. But later Abner fell under a charge, accused of having slept with Saul's concubine Rizpah, daughter of Aiah, and when Ishbosheth reproached him for it, he was deeply hurt and angered, feeling that he was not receiving fair treatment in return for all the care he had taken on Ishbosheth's behalf, and he threatened to turn the kingdom over to David, and to show that it was not through his own strength and judgment that Ishbosheth ruled the lands beyond the Jordan, but through Abner's generalship and loyalty. He sent to David at Hebron, asking to receive oaths and pledges that David would keep him as companion and friend, in return for his winning over the people to abandon Saul's son and proclaim David king of the whole country. David agreed to the terms. He was pleased with what Abner proposed to him through his envoys, but insisted that as a first proof of the agreement, Abner restore to him his wife Michal, whom he had won at great risk, and with 600 Philistine heads, which he had brought to her father Saul as her bride price. So Abner sent Michal to him, taking her from Paltiel, who was then living with her as her husband, with Ishbosheth's cooperation as well. For David had written to him that he should justly get his wife back. Abner then called together the elders of the people, the captains, and the officers, and addressed them, saying that although he had before now turned them back from their readiness to abandon Ishbosheth and side with David, he now let them go whichever way they wished, for he knew that God, through the prophet Samuel, had appointed David king of all the Hebrews, and had foretold that David himself would take vengeance on the Philistines and reduce them to subjection. Hearing this, the elders and the leaders, since Abner's judgment now matched the view they themselves had already held about affairs, changed their allegiance to David's side. Once they were persuaded, Abner called together the tribe of Benjamin, since it was from that tribe that all of Ishbosheth's bodyguard came, and he made the same case to them. And when he found they raised no objection, but went along with what he wanted, he took about 20 companions with him and went to David to receive the oaths from him in person, since agreements each man makes for himself are held to be more trustworthy than those made through another, and also to report to the leaders and to the whole tribe the terms that had been arranged. David received him warmly, entertained him for several days at a lavish and costly table, and Abner asked leave to go and bring the people, so that in David's presence, before their own eyes, they might hand over the kingdom to him. But no sooner had David sent Abner off than Joab, his commander-in-chief, arrived at Hebron, and on learning that Abner had just been with David and had a little before departed under a settlement and agreement about the kingship, he feared that David would honor Abner and give him the first place, making him his partner in the kingdom, since Abner was, besides, a shrewd man skilled at reading affairs and seizing opportunities, while he himself would be diminished and stripped of his command. So he set out on a wicked and treacherous course. First, he tried to slander Abner to the king, warning him to be on his guard and not trust what Abner had agreed to, since everything Abner did was aimed at securing the throne for Saul's son, and that he had come to David with deceit and treachery, meaning to leave again with the very hopes and plans he had set out to arrange. But when he failed to persuade David of this and saw that David was not even provoked by it, he turned to a bolder course still, and, having decided to kill Abner, sent men after him with orders that, once they overtook him, they should summon him in David's name, on the pretext that David had some further business to discuss with him that he had forgotten to mention while Abner was present. When Abner heard the messenger's words, they caught up with him at a place called Beshura, 20 stadia from Hebron, and, suspecting nothing of what was about to happen, he turned back. Joab met him at the gate and greeted him with every show of goodwill and friendship, for men who set their hand to monstrous deeds are quite practiced at feigning the manner of truly good men, so as to keep their plot from being suspected, and drew him away from his own companions, as though to speak with him privately, leading him to a more deserted part of the gate where he was alone with his brother Abishai. There, drawing his sword, he struck him under the ribs. And so Abner died, ambushed in this way by Joab, ostensibly, as Joab himself claimed, in vengeance for his brother Asahel, whom Abner had killed in the battle near Hebron after catching him in pursuit. But in truth, as the matter really stood, because Joab feared for his command and for his standing with the king, lest he himself be stripped of these honors and Abner receive from David the first place instead. From this one may see how far, and to what lengths, men will go out of greed for gain and power and their refusal to yield any part of it to another. Longing to obtain such things, they resort to countless evils to get them, and, fearing to lose them, secure the permanence of their hold by means far worse still. As though winning something so great were no less dangerous a business than keeping it. Power, and a man who has grown used to the good things it brings, only to lose it afterward, since this is the greatest of misfortunes. It is for this reason that everyone, once seized by the fear of losing it, contrives harsher measures and dares terrible deeds. But let this brief statement suffice on that subject. When David heard that Abner had been murdered, he was grieved to the heart, and he called everyone to witness, raising his right hand to God and crying out, that he had had no part in Abner's slaughter and that the man had not died by his order or his own wish. He pronounced terrible curses on the murderer, and he held Joab's whole house and his accomplices answerable to the penalties owed for the dead man, for he was anxious not to seem to have done this in violation of the pledges and oaths he had given Abner. He ordered the whole people, however, to weep and mourn the man and to honor his body with the customary rites, tearing their garments and putting on sackcloth, and to do this while walking before the bier. He himself followed with the elders and the men in command, beating his breast and showing through his tears both his goodwill toward the man while he lived and his grief now that he was dead, and that it was not by his own wish that he had been killed. He buried him at Hebron with great splendor, and having composed dirges for the funeral, he himself stood first at the tomb and led the lament, then handed it over to the others. So thoroughly did the death of Abner overcome him that his companions could not persuade him to take food, and he swore to taste nothing until sunset. This won him the people's goodwill, for those who had been devoted to Abner were deeply pleased at the honor David showed him after his death, and at his fidelity in keeping faith, since he had accorded him everything customary as to a kinsman and friend, and had not, though the man had become his enemy, insulted him with a disorderly and neglected burial. And the rest of the people too rejoiced, as one does at a good and gentle nature, each reckoning that the same care the king had shown toward Abner's corpse he would find shown toward himself in similar circumstances. For this reason especially they were devoted to David, taking care, as was natural, for his good name, since no one suspected him of having had Abner murdered. He also spoke to the people, saying that no ordinary grief had come upon him at the death of a good man, and that it was no small loss to the affairs of the Hebrews to be deprived of one who could hold them together and preserve them, both by the best of counsels and by strength of hand in the deeds of war. "But God," he said, "who cares for all things, will not let this go unavenged for us. And I know well that I am not able to do anything against Joab and Abishai, the sons of Zeruiah, who are more powerful than I am, but the divine will render them the recompense owed for what they have dared." Such was the end to which Abner's life came. When Saul's son Ishbosheth heard of his death, he did not bear it calmly, having lost a kinsman who had also given him the kingdom, but was overcome with grief, and Abner's death pained him greatly. He himself did not live much longer either, but was murdered through a plot by the sons of Eremon, one named Bana and the other Thinos. These men were Benjaminites of the first rank, and reckoning that if they killed Ishbosheth, they would win great gifts from David, together with a command or some other mark of trust, since the deed would recommend them to him, found Ishbosheth resting at noon and asleep, with neither the guards present nor the doorkeeper awake. She too had fallen into sleep from weariness and the work she had been doing, and from the heat. They went into the chamber where Saul's son lay sleeping and killed him, cutting off his head, and traveling through a whole night and day, as men fleeing from those they had wronged toward one who would receive their favor and grant them safety, they arrived at Hebron. They showed David the head of Ishbosheth and presented themselves as loyal men who had done away with his enemy and rival for the kingdom. But David did not receive their deed as they had hoped. Instead, he said, "You most wicked men, who will at once pay the penalty, did you not understand how I punished the murderer of Saul and the man who brought me his golden crown, even though he did the killing as a favor to Saul, so that the enemy might not capture him? Did you suppose that I had changed and was no longer the same man, so as to delight in evildoers and to count as favors your master-killing deeds, done against a righteous man who had done no wrong to anyone, in his own bed, when you yourselves had received much goodwill and honor from him? For this, you will pay the penalty owed to him by being punished, and to me the penalty for having supposed that I would be pleased at Ishbosheth's death, and that this would move you to kill him. For you could not have wronged my good name more than by that assumption." Having said this, he had them tortured with every torment and then put to death, and taking Ishbosheth's head, he had it buried with all honor in Abner's tomb. After these events reached such an end, all the leading men of the people of the Hebrews came to David at Hebron, both their commanders of thousands and their officers, and gave themselves over to him, recalling the goodwill they had held toward him even while Saul was still living, and also the honor which, when he had become a commander of 1,000, they had continued to show him without fail, and declaring that he had been appointed king by God through Samuel the prophet, and his descendants after him, and that it was he who had saved the country of the Hebrews for them by defeating the Philistines, a gift God had granted through him. He welcomed their eagerness, urged them to remain steadfast, for they would have no cause to regret it, feasted them and treated them kindly, and sent the people back to bring to him everyone else. There assembled from the tribe of Judah about 6,800 armed men bearing shield and spear. These had remained with Saul's son, for apart from them, the tribe of Judah had proclaimed David king. From the tribe of Simeon, 7,100. From the tribe of Levi, 4,700, with Jotamus as their commander. With them was the high priest Zadok, together with 22 kinsmen who were leaders. From the tribe of Benjamin, 4,000 armed men for that tribe still waited, expecting that someone of Saul's line would yet become king. From the tribe of Ephraim, 20,800 of the strongest and most outstanding in might. From the half-tribe of Manasseh, 18,000 of the strongest. From the tribe of Issachar, 200 who had foreknowledge of things to come, and 20,000 armed men. From the tribe of Zebulun, 50,000 picked, armed men, this tribe alone came out in full. All of these had the same equipment as the men of the tribe of Gad. From the tribe of Naphtali, 1,000 notable men and leaders equipped with shield and spear, followed by a tribe beyond counting. From the tribe of Dan, 27,600 chosen men. From the tribe of Asher, 40,000. From the two tribes across the Jordan and the rest of the tribe of Manasseh, 120,000 armed with shield, spear, helmet, and sword. And the rest of the tribes used swords. This whole multitude came together to David at Hebron with abundant provision of food and wine and everything needed for sustenance, and with one accord confirmed David as king. After the people had feasted and been entertained for 3 days at Hebron, David set out from there with them all and came to Jerusalem. The inhabitants of the city, the Jebusites, a people of Canaanite stock, shut the gates against him and set upon the wall, in mockery of the king, the blind and the lame and everyone who was maimed, saying that they would keep him from entering, even the disabled would stop him, and they did this out of contempt for the strength of their walls. Enraged, David began to besiege Jerusalem, and applying great effort and zeal, so as to display his strength at once by taking it, and to strike fear into any others who might be disposed toward him as these people were, he took the lower city by force. But the citadel still held out. And the king, knowing this, resolved by promise of honor and rewards to make the soldiers more eager for the task, and he proclaimed that he would give command of the whole army to whoever climbed up to the citadel by way of the ravines beneath it and took it. As everyone was eager to make the climb, and no one shrank from any labor out of desire for the command, Joab son of Zeruiah outstripped the others, and having climbed up, called out to the king demanding the command. Having driven the Jebusites from the citadel and having himself rebuilt Jerusalem, he named the city after himself, the city of David, and he spent all his time there while he reigned. The time during which he ruled over the tribe of Judah alone, at Hebron, came to 7 years and 6 months. Having made Jerusalem his royal seat, he grew ever more splendid in his fortunes, as God provided for him, making his affairs prosper and increase. Hiram, king of Tyre, sent envoys to him and concluded a treaty of friendship and alliance. He also sent him gifts, cedar wood and skilled men, carpenters and builders, who built a palace at Jerusalem. David, having taken the upper city and joined the citadel to it, made them a single body, and having walled it round, he appointed Joab overseer of the walls. David was thus the first to drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem and to name the city after himself. For in the time of Abraham our forefather it was called Salem, but afterward, some say, because Homer too gave it this name, it was called Hierosolyma, for in the Hebrew tongue Hieron renders Solyma, which means safety. The whole time from the campaign and war of Joshua, the general against the Canaanites, in which he defeated them and allotted this land to the Hebrews, down to when the Israelites were no longer able to drive the Canaanites out of Jerusalem, until David took it by siege, was 515 years. I shall also make mention of Ornah, a wealthy man of the Jebusites, who was not killed in the siege of Jerusalem by David because of his goodwill toward the Hebrews, and because of a certain favor and eagerness he showed toward the king, which I will explain more fittingly a little later. David also married other wives besides those he already had, and he took concubines. He fathered 9 sons in all, whom he named Amase, Amnu, Seben, Nathan, Solomon, Ebers, Elian, Phalnagias, Naph, Eni, Eliphil, and also a daughter, Thamar. Of these, 9 were born of women of noble birth, while the last 2 we have named were born of the concubines. Thamar was Absalom's sister by the same mother. When the Philistines learned that David had been made king by the Hebrews, they marched against him toward Jerusalem, and seizing the valley called the Valley of the Giants, a place not far from the city, they encamped there. The king of the Jews, for he was accustomed to do nothing without prophecy, and without bidding God stand as his guarantor concerning things to come, ordered the high priest to foretell what seemed good to God and how the battle would end. When he had prophesied victory and mastery, David led out his forces against the Philistines, and when battle was joined, falling suddenly upon the enemy's rear, he killed some of them and put the rest to flight. Let no one suppose that a small army of Philistines came against the Hebrews, judging from the speed of their defeat, and from the fact that they showed no brave deed worthy of note, that they were slow and cowardly. Rather, let it be known that all Syria and Phoenicia, and besides these many other warlike nations, campaigned together with them and shared in the war. This alone was the reason why, though defeated so often and losing so many tens of thousands, they still came against the Hebrews with greater force. Indeed, having failed even in these battles, a threefold army came against David and encamped in the same place. Again, the king of the Israelites inquired of God concerning the outcome of the battle, and the high priest prophesied that he should hold the army back in the groves called the Weeping Groves, not far from the enemy's camp, and not move it nor begin the battle before the groves were stirred, though no wind was blowing. When the groves were stirred, and the moment God had foretold to him arrived, he delayed no longer but went out to a victory already assured and evident. For the enemy's ranks did not withstand him, but were rooted from the very first clash, and he pressed on killing them. He pursued them as far as the city of Gazara, which is the boundary of their country, plundered their camp, and finding great wealth in it, destroyed their gods as well. When this battle too had ended in this way, David resolved, after taking counsel with the elders and the officers and the commanders of thousands, to summon the men of fighting age from every part of the country belonging to his own people, and then the priests and Levites, and to go to Kiriath-Jearim and bring up the Ark of God from there to Jerusalem, and to worship it there from then on with sacrifices and the other honors in which the divine takes delight, for if they had done this even while Saul was still reigning, they would have suffered no harm. So, when all the people had assembled, as they had resolved, the king came to the ark, which the priests had lifted from the house of Amminadab and placed on a new cart, and entrusted brothers and sons to draw it along with of oxen. The king led the way, and the whole crowd with him hymned God and sang every kind of native song, with a rich accompaniment of instruments, dances, and psalms, and trumpet and cymbals besides, as they brought the ark down toward Jerusalem. But when they had come as far as the thrashing floor of Chidon, a place so called, Uzzah died by the anger of God. For when the oxen shook the ark, he stretched out his hand and tried to steady it, and because he was not a priest and had touched it, God caused his death. The king and the people were distressed at Uzzah's death, and the place where he died is called the Breach. David, afraid, and reasoning that he might suffer the same fate as Uzzah if he received the ark into the city with him, since that man had died merely for stretching out his hand toward it, did not bring it in to himself in the city, but turned aside to the estate of a righteous man, a Levite named Obeddom, and set the ark down with him. It remained there 3 full months, and in that time the house of Obeddom prospered greatly and received a large share of blessings. When the king heard that this had happened to Obeddom, and that he had suddenly risen from poverty and humble station to prosperity, and became the envy of all who saw or heard about his household, he took courage, confident that he would suffer no harm, and moved the ark to himself. The priests carried it, 7 choirs which the king had arranged went ahead of it, and David himself played and struck the strings of a lyre, so that his wife Michal, daughter of Saul the first king, seeing him doing this, mocked him. When they had brought the ark in, they set it beneath the tent David had pitched for it, and he offered whole burnt offerings and peace offerings, and feasted the whole crowd, both women and men and children, giving out to each a small round loaf of bread, a portion of roasted meat, a fried cake, and a share of the sacrificial victim. Having thus feasted the people, he sent them away and returned to his own house. Michal, Saul's daughter, came out to meet him. She wished him well in other things, and prayed that God would grant him all he could, since he was in God's favor. But she also reproached him for having disgraced himself, so great a king, by dancing and exposing himself in his dancing before slaves and serving women. He answered that he was not ashamed to do what was pleasing to God, who had honored him above her father and everyone else, and that he would play and dance again and again, caring nothing that it might seem shameful to the servant women, since he took no such view of it himself. This Michal, though she lived with David, bore him no children. Later, when she was given in marriage to the man to whom her father Saul had once handed her, and David then took her back from him by force, she bore 5 children. We shall speak of these in their proper place. Seeing that in almost every day his affairs were turning out better through the will of God, the king thought he was doing wrong if, while he himself lived in a house built of cedar, lofty and furnished with every fine appointment, he allowed the ark to remain lying in a tent. He wanted to build a temple for God, as Moses had said, and he spoke of this with Nathan the prophet. Since Nathan told him to do whatever he had set his mind on, as God was with him and would cooperate with him in everything, David grew even more eager about building the temple. But that same night, God appeared to Nathan and ordered him to tell David that he accepted his intention and desire. Since no one before him had thought of building him a temple, though it was David who had first conceived the plan, but that he would not allow a man who had fought many wars and been stained with the blood of enemies to build him a temple. After David's death, however, once he had grown old and lived out a long life, the temple would be built by his son, who would succeed him in the kingdom and would be called Solomon. God promised to watch over and provide for him as a father does for a son, to keep the kingdom for his descendants and hand it down to them, and to punish him, if he should sin, with sickness and famine in the land. When David learned this from the prophet, he was overjoyed to know for certain that the rule would remain with his descendants and that his house would be glorious and celebrated. And he went to the ark, fell on his face, and began to worship and to give thanks to God for everything, for having already raised him from a humble shepherd to so great a height of rule and glory, and for what he had promised his descendants, and for the providence he had shown toward the freedom of the Hebrews. Having said this and hymned God, he departed. After a short interval, he decided he must march out against the Philistines, unwilling to let his affairs grow idle or slack in anything, so that, having subdued his enemies as God had foretold to him, he might leave his descendants ruling thereafter in peace. He called the army together again, ordered it to be ready and prepared for war, and when he judged the moment right, marched out from Jerusalem against the Philistines with his forces. Having defeated them in battle and cut off a large part of their territory, annexing it to that of the Hebrews, he next carried the war against the Moabites, and defeating 2/3 of their army in battle, he destroyed them, taking the remainder captive. He imposed on them a yearly tribute. He then campaigned against Hadadezer son of Rahab, king of Zobah, and joining battle with him by the Euphrates River, he destroyed about 20,000 of his infantry and about 5,000 of his cavalry. He also captured 1,000 of his chariots, most of which he destroyed, keeping only 100 for himself. When Hadad, king of Damascus and of Syria, heard that David was warring against Hadadezer, being his friend he came with a strong force to help him, but the outcome was as he had feared. Joining battle by the Euphrates River, he was defeated and lost many of his soldiers, for 20,000 of Hadad's force fell at the hands of the Hebrews, and all the rest fled. Nicolaus too mentions this king in the 4th book of his histories, writing as follows. Long afterward, a certain man of the region named Hadad, having grown more powerful, ruled over Damascus and the rest of Syria, except Phoenicia. He made war on David, king of Judea, and after being tried in many battles in the last of them, fought by the Euphrates, in which he was defeated, he was judged to be the best of kings in strength and courage. And besides this, he also speaks of his descendants, saying that after his death they received the kingdom and the name from one another in succession, writing thus. After his death, his descendants reigned for 10 generations, each receiving from his father both the rule and the name together, just as the Ptolemies do in Egypt. The third of them, who had grown mightiest of all, wishing to avenge his ancestors' defeat, marched against the Jews and ravaged the land now called Samaria. Nicolaus does not miss the truth here, for this is the Hadad who campaigned against Samaria in the reign of Ahab, king of the Israelites, of whom we shall speak in the proper place. David, having campaigned against Damascus and all the rest of Syria, made it wholly subject to himself, stationing garrisons in the country and fixing the tribute they were to pay, then returned. The golden quivers and suits of armor worn by Hadad's bodyguards he dedicated to God at Jerusalem, the very ones which the Egyptian King Shishak later took when he campaigned against David's grandson Rehoboam, carrying off besides much other wealth from Jerusalem. We shall tell of this when we come to its proper place. As God favored the king of the Hebrews and gave him success in his wars, he also campaigned against the finest cities of Hadadezer, Beta, and Baradai, and taking them by force plundered them. A great quantity of gold was found in them, and silver and bronze too, which they said was better than the gold, the very bronze from which Solomon later made the great vessel called the sea, and those beautiful basins when he built the temple for God. When the king of Hamath learned what had happened to Hadadezer and heard that his forces had been destroyed, fearing for himself, he resolved to bind David to himself in friendship and trust before David should come against him, and sent to him his son Joram, acknowledging his gratitude for David's having warred against Hadadezer, who was also his enemy, and offering an alliance and friendship. He also sent him gifts, vessels of ancient workmanship in gold, silver, and bronze. David, having made the alliance with Toi, for that was the name of the king of Hamath, and received the gifts, sent his son back with the honor due to both parties. What was sent to him, along with the rest of the gold and silver he had taken from the cities and the nations he had subdued, he brought and dedicated to God. Nor did God grant victory and success only to David himself when he fought and led the army in person, when he sent Abishai, brother of Joab the commander-in-chief, with a force into Idumea, he gave the Hebrews victory over the Idumeans through him as well, for Abishai destroyed 18,000 of them in battle. The king garrisoned all Idumea and received from them tribute for the land and a poll tax for each person. He was also just by nature and rendered his judgments with an eye to the truth. He had Joab as commander of the whole army. Over the records, he set Jehoshaphat son of Ahilud. From the house of Phinehas, he appointed Zadok high priest along with Abiathar, since he was his friend. He made Sariah secretary. To Benaiah son of Jehuda, he gave command of the bodyguard, and his elder sons attended his person and served as his guard. He also remembered the covenant and oaths he had made with Jonathan, Saul's son, and Jonathan's friendship and devotion toward him. For besides all the other good qualities he possessed, he was most mindful, for all time, of those who had done him good. He therefore ordered a search to be made for anyone still living from Jonathan's family, to whom he might repay the debt he owed Jonathan for his friendship. A man was brought to him who had been freed by Saul, and who knew who among that family still survived. David asked him whether he could name any relative of Jonathan still alive who might receive in return the favor of the kindnesses he himself had received from Jonathan. The man said a son of his survived, named Mephibosheth, who was lame in both feet. For after news came that the child's father and grandfather had fallen in battle, his nurse had snatched him up and fled, and in her flight he had fallen from her shoulders and his feet were injured. Learning where and with whom the boy was being raised, David sent to Machir, in the city of Lodbar, for it was with him that Jonathan's son was being brought up, and summoned him to himself. Mephibosheth came to the king, fell on his face, and did obeisance to him. David urged him to take courage and expect better things, and gave him his father's house and all the property that his grandfather Saul had owned, ordered that he should eat at his table as a companion, and that he should not be absent a single day from dining with him. When the boy had done obeisance for these words and gifts, David called Ziba and told him he had given the ancestral house to the boy along with all of Saul's estate, and ordered Ziba himself to work the land and, taking charge of everything, to bring the produce to Jerusalem, and to bring himself and his sons. There were 15 of them, each day to David's own table, along with Mephibosheth, and he granted to the boy Ziba's servants, who numbered 20. When the king had arranged all this, Ziba did obeisance, promised to do everything, and withdrew, while Jonathan's sons settled in Jerusalem, dining with the king and receiving every attention as though he were his own son. A son was also born to him, whom he named Micah. Those who survived from the family of Saul and Jonathan received these honors from David. About that time, Nahash, king of the Ammonites, who had been his friend, died, and his son Hanun succeeded to the kingdom. David sent envoys to him, urging him to bear his father's death calmly, and promising that the same friendship he had shown Nahash would continue toward him. But the rulers of the Ammonites received this in bad faith, not in the spirit David intended, and urged their king on, saying that David had sent spies to survey their country and their strength under the pretense of kindness, and they advised him to be on guard and not to heed David's words, lest he be deceived and fall into irremediable disaster. Hanun, king of the Ammonites, thinking the rulers spoke more plausibly than the truth, treated the envoys David had sent with harsh insult. He shaved off half of each man's beard, cut off half their garments, and sent them away, their answer conveyed in deeds rather than words. When the king of the Israelites saw this, he was furious, and it was clear he would not overlook the outrage and insult, but would make war on the Ammonites and exact from their king punishment for this offense against his envoys. When the Ammonites learned this, his kinsmen and commanders, seeing that they had broken faith and owed a reckoning for it, began preparing for war. They sent to Cyrus, king of the Mesopotamian Syrians, 1,000 talents to persuade him to become their ally for that fee, and did the same with Sauba. Between the two kings, they had 20,000 infantry. They also hired the king of the land called Maacah and a fourth, named Astoboz, together bringing 12,000 heavy infantry. David was not daunted by this alliance or by the strength of the Ammonites. Trusting in God and convinced that he would be fighting them justly for the outrage he had suffered, he gave Joab, his commander-in-chief, the fittest part of the army and sent him against them. Joab encamped before Arabatha, the Ammonite capital. When the enemy came out and drew up for battle, they did not form as one body but in two. The mercenary force was posted apart on the plain, while the Ammonite army stood by the gates, facing the Hebrews. Seeing this, Joab devised a countermeasure of his own. Choosing his bravest men, he drew them up opposite the Syrian and his allied kings, and gave the rest to his brother Abishai with orders to form up against the Ammonites. He told Abishai that if he saw the Syrians pressing him hard and gaining the upper hand, he should wheel his line around and come to his aid, and that he himself would do the same if he saw Abishai being worn down by the Ammonites. Having encouraged his brother in this way, and urged him to fight with the spirit and eagerness proper to men who fear disgrace, he sent him off to engage the Ammonites, while he himself joined battle with the Syrians. After holding out stubbornly for a little while, the Syrians were routed. Joab killed many of them and forced the whole force to flight. Seeing this, and afraid of Abishai and the troops with him, the Ammonites did not stand their ground either, but followed their allies' example and fled into the city. Having thus mastered the enemy, Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king in triumph. This defeat did not persuade the Ammonites to keep quiet, nor did they learn from stronger men to remain at peace. Instead, they sent to Chalamaz, king of the Syrians beyond the Euphrates, and hired him as an ally. He had as his commander-in-chief Sabikos, with 80,000 infantry and 10,000 cavalry. When the king of the Hebrews learned that the Ammonites had again gathered so great a force against him, he decided he could no longer fight them through his generals, but crossed the Jordan himself with the whole army. Meeting the enemy, he joined battle and won. He killed about 40,000 of their infantry and about 7,000 cavalry, and wounded Chalamaz's general Sabikos, who died of the wound. The Mesopotamians, the battle having ended so, surrendered themselves to David and sent him gifts. He himself returned to Jerusalem for the winter season, and at the beginning of spring, sent his commander-in-chief Joab to make war on the Ammonites. Joab overran their whole land, laying it waste, and shut them up in their capital, Arabatha, which he besieged. It was at this time that a grave misfortune befell David, a man naturally just and God-fearing, who kept faithfully to the laws of his ancestors. One evening, watching from the roof of the palace, where it was his custom to walk at that hour, he saw a woman bathing in cold water in her own house, a woman of the greatest beauty, surpassing all others. Her name was Bathsheba. He was overcome by the woman's beauty, and unable to master his desire, he had her brought to him. When the woman conceived, she sent to the king asking him to find some way of concealing the offense, since by their ancestral laws she was liable to die as an adulteress. David summoned from the siege one of Joab's armor-bearers, the woman's husband, whose name was Uriah, and on his arrival questioned him about the army and the siege. When Uriah said that everything was going as they wished, David took portions from his own dinner and gave them to him, and told him to go home to his wife and rest with her. But Uriah did not do so. Instead, he lay down to sleep by the king's doors along with the other armor-bearers. When the king learned of this, he questioned him as to why he had not gone to his own house or to his wife after so long a time away, when it is the nature of all men to do so when they return from a campaign. Uriah answered that it was not right for him to rest and indulge himself with a woman while his fellow soldiers and his commander were sleeping on the ground in camp, in enemy territory. Having said this, he was ordered to remain there that day, so that he might be sent back to the commander-in-chief the next day. Invited to dine with the king, Uriah drank to the point of drunkenness, the king plying him deliberately with toasts, but even so he again slept before the king's doors, feeling no desire at all for his wife. Exasperated by this, the king wrote to Joab ordering him to punish Uriah, making clear that Uriah had committed some fault, and, so that his own wish in the matter should not become apparent, he suggested the manner of the punishment. He ordered Joab to post him in the most exposed sector of the enemy line, at a point where he would be in danger of being left alone in the fighting, for he instructed that his fellow soldiers should withdraw once the battle began. Having written this and sealed the letter with his own signet, he gave it to Uriah to carry to Joab. Joab received the letter, and having read the king's design, stationed Uriah, together with some of the army's best men, at the very point where he knew the enemy had proved most dangerous. He himself declared he would come up in support with the whole force if they could breach part of the wall and get into the city. Since Uriah was a fine soldier who enjoyed a reputation with the king and with all his countrymen for courage, Joab thought it right to let him welcome great hardships rather than resent them. Uriah eagerly undertook the task, and Joab told the men posted alongside him to abandon him privately whenever they saw the enemy charging out. So when the Hebrews attacked the city, the Ammonites, fearing that the enemy might scale the wall before they could stop them at the very point where Uriah happened to be posted, put their bravest men forward, threw open the gate, and suddenly rushed out upon the enemy with great force and speed. Seeing them, all the men with Uriah withdrew, just as Joab had told them to. But Uriah, ashamed to flee and abandon his post, stood his ground against the enemy. Receiving their charge, he killed no small number of them, but was surrounded, caught in their midst, and died there, along with a few others who fell alongside him. When this had happened, Joab sent messengers to the king, instructing them to say that he had been eager to take the city quickly, but that after assaulting the wall and losing many men he had been forced to withdraw, and to add, if the king grew angry at this, the news of Uriah's death as well. When the king heard this from the messengers, he was indignant, saying that they had done wrong to assault the wall, when they ought instead to have tried to take the city by mines and siege engines, citing as an example Gideon's son Abimelech, who, wishing to take the tower at Thebes by force, was struck by a stone thrown by an old woman and fell. And though a most courageous man died shamefully because of the recklessness of his attempt. Men should remember him and not approach the enemy's wall too closely, for it is best, of all things done in war, whether they turned out well or badly, to keep such risks in memory, so as to imitate some and guard against others. But when the messenger, finding him in this mood, told him also of Uriah's death, he ceased from his anger. He ordered the messenger to go and tell Joab that what had happened was merely human, and that war has this nature. Sometimes it turns out well for one side, sometimes for the other. For the future, however, Joab should take care over the siege, so that they suffer no further reverse in it, but should reduce the city by earthworks and siege engines, and once they had mastered it, raise the city to the ground and destroy everyone in it. The messenger hurried back to Joab carrying the king's orders. Meanwhile, Uriah's wife Bathsheba, on learning of her husband's death, mourned him for many days, and once she had ceased her grief and her weeping over Uriah, the king at once took her as his wife, and she bore him a son. God was not pleased by this marriage. Angry with David, he appeared to the prophet Nathan in a dream and reproached the king through him. Nathan, a shrewd and intelligent man, reasoning that kings, once they fall into anger, give more weight to their passion than to justice, decided not to state God's threats outright, but instead related to him another, gentler kind of story, wishing to make clear to David, by this means, what he thought of what David had done. Two men, he said, lived in the same city. One was rich and owned many flocks of cattle, sheep, and other livestock. The poor man had only a single ewe lamb, which he raised together with his children, sharing his food with her and treating her with the affection one might show a daughter. When a guest arrived at the rich man's house, the rich man would not consent to slaughter any of his own flocks to entertain his friend. Instead, he sent for the poor man's lamb, seized it, prepared it, and feasted his guest with it. This story greatly distressed the king, and he declared to Nathan that the man who had dared to do such a thing deserved to pay fourfold for the lamb, and beyond that, to be punished with death. Nathan replied that David himself was the man he had just condemned by his own judgment, for daring so great and terrible a deed. He then uncovered and laid bare to him the full anger of God, who had made him king over the whole power of the Hebrews and lord of many great nations round about, who had rescued him earlier still from the hands of Saul, and had given him wives whom he had lawfully and rightfully married, and who had been despised and wronged by him, since he had taken another man's wife and had put her husband to death by handing him over to the enemy. For this, Nathan said, David would pay the penalty to God. His own wives would be violated by one of his sons, and he himself would be plotted against by that same son, and the wrong he had done in secret would be punished openly. Moreover, the son born to him of that woman would die at once. The king was shaken by this and overcome with grief. With tears he confessed that he had sinned, for he was by common consent a God-fearing man who had committed no wrong at all in his life except in the matter of Uriah's wife. God took pity on him, was reconciled, and promised to preserve both his life and his kingdom, saying that since he repented of what had happened, he would no longer deal harshly with him. Having prophesied these things to the king, Nathan went home. God struck the child born of Uriah's wife with a grave illness. David, distressed by this, refused all food for 7 days, though his household urged him to eat. He put on black clothing and lay on the ground on sackcloth, imploring God for the child's life, for he loved its mother deeply. On the 7th day, the child died, and his servants did not dare tell the king, reasoning that if he learned of it, he would abstain even more from food and from all other care of himself, as would be natural for one whose beloved child had died, when even during its illness grief had made him treat himself so harshly. But the king noticed that his servants were troubled and behaving as people do when they most want to conceal something, and understood that the child had died. He called one of the servants to him and, learning the truth, rose up, bathed, put on white clothing, and went to the tent of God. Then he ordered dinner to be served to him, causing great astonishment among his relatives and servants at this unexpected behavior, since he had done none of these things while the child was ill, yet now, once it had died, did them all at once. When they asked the reason and begged leave first to ask him about it, he told them they were ignorant and explained. While the child still lived, he had reason to hope for its recovery, and so did everything that was fitting, believing that God would in this way be made favorable toward it. But once it had died, there was no further use in vain grief. Hearing this, they praised the king's wisdom and understanding. He then went in to his wife Bathsheba again and made her pregnant. When she bore a male child, he named him Solomon, as the prophet Nathan had directed. Meanwhile, Joab pressed the siege of the Ammonites hard, cutting them off from their water and from their other supplies, so that they suffered greatly from lack of drink and food, for they depended on a small well and cistern, using it sparingly so that the spring would not fail them completely. He then wrote to the king to report this and to urge him to come and take the city himself, so that the victory might be credited to him. When Joab's letter arrived, the king, approving of his loyalty and good faith, took the force that was with him and came to storm Rabbatha. Taking it by force, he allowed the soldiers to plunder it. He himself took the crown of the king of the Ammonites, a talent of gold in weight, set with a costly sardonyx stone in the center. David wore it on his head from then on. He He found much other splendid and costly plunder in the city as well, and he tortured the men to death. He did the same to the other cities of the That was how he treated the other cities of the Ammonites too, taking them all by force. When the king returned to Jerusalem, a disaster befell his household for the following reason. He had a daughter, still a virgin, of such striking beauty that she surpassed all the loveliest women. Her name was Tamar, and she shared the same mother as Absalom. Amnon, the eldest of David's sons, fell in love with her, and since he could obtain the object of his desire neither because of her virginity nor because of how closely she was guarded, he fell into a wretched state. His body wasted away under the torment consuming him, and his color changed. He could not hide what he was suffering from a certain kinsman and friend named Jonadab, a man of unusual intelligence and sharp understanding. Noticing every morning that Amnon was not himself physically, Jonadab came to him and asked him to explain the reason, guessing on his own that Amnon was in the grip of erotic desire. When Amnon admitted his condition, that he was in love with his sister, who shared the same father, Jonadab suggested a way and a device for him to obtain what he longed for. He advised Amnon to pretend to be ill, and when their father came to see him, to ask that his sister be sent to attend to him, since he would find relief and quickly be rid of the illness once that happened. So Amnon took to his bed and feigned sickness, following Jonadab's advice. When their father came and asked how he was, Amnon begged him to send his sister to him, and the king at once ordered her brought. When she arrived, he directed her to make him some fried cakes with her own hands, since he would eat more gladly from her hands. She kneaded the flour while her brother watched, shaped the cakes, fried them, and brought them to him. But he did not taste them then. Instead, he ordered the servants to withdraw from the chamber, saying he wanted to rest, free of noise and disturbance. When his order had been carried out, he asked his sister to bring the food into the inner room to him. She did so, but as soon as she came near, he seized her and tried to persuade her to lie with him. The girl cried out, "No, do not force me to this, and do not commit this outrage, brother. You would be breaking the law and wrapping yourself in terrible shame. Stop this unjust and vile desire, from which our house will reap only reproach and disgrace." She urged him to speak to their father about it, for he would surely consent. She said this only to escape, for the moment, the onrush of his passion. But he would not be persuaded. Burning with love and goaded by the stings of his passion, he forced his sister. Hatred entered Amnon at once after the assault, and after heaping abuse on her, he ordered her to get up and leave. When she protested that this was an even worse outrage, for having violated her, he would not even let her stay until nightfall, but ordered her out at once in broad daylight so that she would meet witnesses to her shame. He had her thrown out by a servant. Overwhelmed with grief at the outrage and the violence done to her, she tore her tunic, for in ancient times unmarried girls wore long-sleeved tunics reaching to the ankles, so as not to be seen bare, poured ashes over her head, and went off through the middle of the city crying out and lamenting the violence. Her brother Absalom happened upon her and asked what terrible thing had befallen her to leave her in such a state. When she told him of the outrage, he comforted her, urging her to keep calm and bear it patiently, and not to think herself dishonored, since it was her brother who had violated her. Persuaded by him, she stopped her crying and no longer spoke of the assault before many people, and for a long time she lived on, widowed in effect, in the household of her brother Absalom. When their father David learned of this, he was distressed at what had happened, but since he loved Amnon deeply, he was, after all, his eldest son, he was forced to hold back from grieving him. Absalom, however, hated Amnon bitterly, and in secret he watched for an opportune moment to avenge his sister's wrong. A second year had now passed since the wrong done to his sister, and as Absalom was about to go out to Baal-Hazor, a town in the territory allotted to Ephraim, for the shearing of his own flocks, he invited his father, along with his brothers, to come and feast with him. When David declined, so as not to be a burden to him, Absalom asked that his brothers be sent instead. When they were sent, Absalom instructed his own men that as soon as they saw Amnon overcome and heavy with wine, they should kill him at Absalom's signal, fearing no one. When they had carried out the order, shock and confusion seized the brothers, and in terror they mounted their horses and rode off to their father. But someone reached him first with the report that all of them had been killed by Absalom. since the grief over the loss of so many sons at once, and at the hand of a brother, which made it seem all the more bitter, since it could have been prevented, overwhelmed him. He was swept away by his suffering and did not stop to inquire into the cause or to learn anything else, as one would naturally do when such a great calamity is reported, and because of its enormity, hard to credit. Instead, he tore his clothes, threw himself to the ground, and lay there mourning all his sons, both those reported dead and the one who had killed them. Jonadab, the son of his brother Shammah, urged him to relax his grief somewhat. As for the others, he said, David should not believe they were dead, for there was no reason to suppose so. But as for Amnon, he said David should make inquiry, since it was likely that Absalom, because of the outrage done to Tamar, had dared to kill him. At that moment, the sound of horses and the commotion of men approaching made them turn. It was the king's sons who had fled from the feast. Their father met them weeping with grief, and, against his expectation, saw alive those he had just heard were dead a little while before. There was weeping and groaning from everyone, from the brothers, as though for one who had died, and from the king, as though for a son who had been slaughtered. Absalom fled to Jeshur, to his maternal grandfather, who ruled that region, and remained with him 3 full years. David had a desire to send for his son Absalom, not to bring him back for punishment, but so that he might be with him, for time had softened his anger. Joab, the commander-in-chief, urged him toward this all the more, for he arranged for a certain woman, already advanced in years, to come before the king in mourning dress, as if her sons had quarreled while working in the fields, and, falling into a violent dispute with no one present able to stop them, one had struck and killed the other. She begged that, since her relatives had risen up against the one who had done the killing and were seeking to put him to death, the king would grant her the life of her son and not deprive her of her remaining hopes for care in her old age, and that by preventing this, he would keep those who wished to kill her son from doing so, for they would restrain themselves out of fear of no one but him. When David agreed to what the woman pleaded, she took up the matter again, saying to the king, "Thanks be to you already for your kindness in taking pity on my old age and my near childlessness. But so that your favor to me may be made secure, first be reconciled with your own son and let go of your anger toward him. For how could I believe that you have truly granted me this favor, when you yourself remain estranged from your own son on similar grounds until now? It would be utterly senseless to add, of your own free will, another son to the one who died against your intention." The king perceived that the pretext was put into the old woman's mouth by Joab and his zeal for the matter, and when he had learned from her, upon questioning, that this was indeed so, he summoned Joab and told him that he had succeeded in his purpose and ordered him to bring Absalom back, for he was no longer harsh toward him, but had already let go of his anger and wrath. Joab bowed before the king, welcomed his words with joy, set out at once for Jeshur, and, taking Absalom with him, came to Jerusalem. The king sent word ahead to his son, for he had heard of his arrival, directing him to go to his own house, since he was not yet prepared to see him at once upon his return. Absalom, in obedience to his father's order, kept out of his sight and continued to receive the care of his household. His good looks had not been harmed by his grief or by his failure to receive the attention due a king's son. Rather, he still stood out and excelled in every respect, in both the beauty and the stature of his body, surpassing even those who lived amid every luxury.